a great sports enthusiast, and he has watched great Olympic athletes perform, analyze their performances through the eyes of a physicist, and he's written a book called Gold Medal Physics, The Science of Sports. Good morning, sir. Welcome to News Talk 96.9.
Good morning. Glad to be with you.
Now, just in terms of sheer mechanical performance, these guys are amazing, aren't they?
They sure are. It was a lot of fun researching for the book and investigating all the little things that these athletes were doing that sets them apart from the rest of us.
And what are some of those differences?
Well, from a science point of view, the laws of physics constrain what everybody can do. So in other words, if you are able to jump at a certain speed off the ground, there's only so high you can go. And if everybody can jump at that speed, we're all going to go the same height. The trick is doing everything perfectly while you're jumping, while you're in the air, moving your arms and legs the right way. So what the top athletes are able to do is maximize to reach the ceiling of what physics constrains us to do.
And how much of this is physical ability on the part of the athlete, and how much of this is learned and studied technique?
I think you get a lot of both of those. You get a lot of training. You develop muscle memory by repetitive action. If you're throwing a football, if you're out there playing high school football in Texas, you've probably thrown the ball a few hundred thousand times before you're out on that field on Friday night. So the athletes have a lot of practice. They have a lot of conditioning going into it. And, of course, there's the psychology of being in the zone. They have to be able to put all those athletic talents to use at the right moment.
Well, let's talk about being in the zone. What exactly does that describe? And is it a state of mind where you forget consciously all the training that you've had, and you just let that muscle memory and that experience take over?
I don't know that you necessarily forget it. I liken it to driving a car for the rest of us. We get into a car and we turn it on and drive, and we're obviously looking where we're going, but we're not thinking back to the time when we had our learner's permit and how fast should we be going in a school zone, or how far should we be following behind another car, or keeping the car between the lines. You know, all that stuff comes very naturally. And for an athlete on a much higher athletic plane, of course, the athlete in the zone is able to maximize everything that science says you can do to a certain limit at just the right time. So being in the zone involves a lot of psychology as well as physics.
And let's talk about physics a little bit. Which ones of Mr. Newton's laws come into play most when we're talking about athletic performance?
Well, all three of Newton's laws come into play. In fact, those laws were written down over 300 years ago, and the amazing thing about what Newton did is we're still using them. Only in the world of atoms and things moving very, very fast does Newton get the wrong answer. So for the sports world, Isaac Newton pretty much tells us what's going on.
And is this something that coaches and trainers consciously go out with the blackboard and write the formula? Well, velocity here and blah, blah here.
I don't believe that's done so much at the kind of the lower levels of athletic training. Certainly once you get more into the elite status, where there's a great deal of money on the line, endorsements are on the line, winning is a very lucrative thing, people are brought in, scientists are brought in, engineers are brought in to help maximize an athlete's performance. So engineers and scientists play a large role in designing NASCARs. They invest a great deal of time and money into clothing. So some of the skiers that we're seeing going down these hills at amazing speeds in the Olympics have skin-tight clothing to reduce drag. The helmets are of a given shape to help reduce the air drag. The poles are curved. They go behind their body. So there's a lot of things that people have learned from science that they put to good use in sports.
And let's talk about equipment. Can well-designed, scientifically engineered equipment make a bad athlete better than a good athlete with cruddy equipment?
I don't think that a bad athlete's ever going to be a good athlete, even with great equipment. I mean, I think the differences that science is able to provide, if you've seen some of the winning times and some of the alpine races, for example, I mean, these things are separated by 7 or 9 hundredths of a second. So any little competitive advantage that one can get from the technique that's used, the clothing that's used, all of within the rules, of course. You look at Michael Phelps in the last Summer Olympics. I mean, you know, the 8th gold medal was achieved just with, you know, the touch of a hand coming out. So these races that are determined by tenths or even hundredths of a second, you know, any little training advantage that science might provide or with the equipment can certainly make a difference at that level.
Tell us about your book, Gold Medal Physics, The Science of Sports. You follow several athletes in there and analyze their performances?
That's right. So I start the book off with what's quickly becoming or probably has become America's pastime, which is football. And I look at a couple of great sporting moments from my youth. I remember the play in which Stanford beat Cal with the 5 laterals in 82. I look at Doug Flutie's Hail Mary pass back in 84. And then I move on to some more Olympic, traditional Olympic events. So people like Bob Beamon, his famous jump in 1968 where as soon as he left the ground, he jumped 7% farther than any other human had ever jumped. And I was fascinated by that growing up, even though I wasn't alive for that event. So I analyzed that. I looked at Greg Louganis and Katarina Witt's dominance in the 80s in diving and ice skating. And then I also looked at Al Euter. And if your listeners don't know the name Al Euter, I hope someday they will, because he's an often forgotten Olympic athlete who dominated the discus. This is a person who won the gold medal in 4 consecutive Olympics, starting in 1956 and ending in 68. And each time he won the gold medal in the discus, he shattered the Olympic record. I also looked at more international sports like Tour de France racing with Lance Armstrong and soccer kicking with David Beckham. And then I finished off the book going even more international with a look at sumo.
Oh, that's got to be interesting.
That was a very interesting chapter to research, that's right.
Oh, well, tell us a little bit about the physics of sumo wrestling.
Well, when the athletes get in the ring, or the rikishi as it's called, the perception I think a lot of us in the U.S. have is that, you know, these are big fat guys and they're just bumping into each other. There's an enormous amount of training and athleticism and, believe it or not, flexibility in these athletes. And a typical sumo match only lasts a few seconds. Somebody can be dominated very quickly and the edge comes down to physics. If somebody makes a collision with another sumo athlete, the edge in momentum, in linear momentum, when the collision takes place, is all that one needs to get the opponent out of the ring.
And a lot of that is based on how low your center of gravity is. Is that anywhere close to right?
That's right. Certainly, your listeners who are in a football country down in Texas are going to know that it's harder to tackle somebody when they stay low. They're taught to stay low. And by keeping your center of mass low, you enhance stability. So what they will do is they will come in low and then attack high so that they can get the leverage on their opponent and either push the opponent down or stay low and drive them out of the ring.
Now, go ahead, Jer.
No, I'm trying to, I've got that part of that, Dan. I'm trying to figure out on the football angle. I'm trying to figure out the physics in the football game where the Stanford band gets credit for part of the play.
Well, that's right. When the trombone player Gary Terrell came out and got smashed, that was probably the main highlight. What I was interested in, and I want to make it perfectly clear to you all and to your listeners, that a physicist is not trying to dehumanize sports. My jaw drops just as much as yours when I see these things happen, and it's only later that I try to analyze it and figure it out and understand it from a science point of view. And after that crazy play, after I watched it a few times, what fascinated me was the lateral, because a player can believe that he's actually pitching the ball backward, which would be a legal lateral. But in the referee's frame of reference, it's actually moving forward. So you see these arguments on the field sometimes where a ref will call an illegal forward pass and the player will just swear the ball was pitched backwards. And a really simple example to illustrate that is if you were standing in the back of a van or a pickup truck or whatever, wherever you could stand in a moving vehicle, and it was moving 30 miles an hour, and you pitched a football backwards, straight back out of the truck, at 10 miles an hour, with respect to yourself, you would think you threw it backwards. But somebody on the ground would see you going by. The football is going 10 miles an hour back, plus the 30 miles an hour from the truck. It's really going 20 miles an hour forward. So I got really interested in frame of reference, and the players are not always right, even though in their frame of reference they actually are. It's not, but their frame of reference isn't what counts. It's the referees.
That's true. That's exactly right.
JR is a referee, by the way. So,
see, and I'm looking at the yard line that he threw it from, and the yard line where it got caught. That's how I'm deciding back.
That's right. Refereeing is very challenging, and the referees are moving, so they have their own frame of reference, and they have to try to judge the pitch point and where the ball is caught, and look in their mind whether that was actually forward or backward.
Well, now, what's the biggest misnomer out there in sports that's related to the physics? Like, to me, there's all baseball and the way a ball rotates and all the things they can do to make it move. You know, does a guy actually have a riser?
No. You do hear a lot of things like that in baseball. You hear things about hanging in the air in basketball. The idea behind a fastball is the way it's thrown, you're pulling back on the ball when you're letting go of it. So it's rotating with a lot of backspin, if you will, if you're thinking about tennis, toward the catcher. And what happens is the ball does not fall down as much as it would if it didn't have that rotation. So the perception is that it rises because we have so much trained muscle memory and how a ball is supposed to go. If an athlete like, you know, a hard-throwing Texan like Nolan Ryan can put a 100-mile-an-hour heater in there, that's going to have a lot of backspin, and it's just not going to drop as much. It still drops in that 0.4 of a second to the plate. It still drops, just not as much as what the batter would be used to, and the perception is, yeah, it's rising. And it's the same thing with a curveball. If you look at someone like back in the day, a Burt Blyleven, mysteriously not Hall of Famer Burt Blyleven, but when he would throw the curveball he had and pull his fingers down the front of the ball, that thing would drop more than it would if it didn't have that spin. So the perception that people have is based on what they're used to, the trajectory they're used to.
Oh, that's fascinating stuff. And I guess even the physics of optics a lot of times comes into play here.
That's right. And one of the things you're taught playing baseball is to keep your eye on the ball. I think we've all heard that expression in Little League. And people have done studies and actually demonstrated, proven, that the human eye cannot follow a baseball along that trajectory on that 0.4 or 0.5 of a second to the plate. What happens is the eye picks the ball up in a few places, and muscle memory takes over. I mean, we know where the ball is released from the pitcher's hand. We pick it up in a couple more places, and the mind, that amazing organ we have in our head, is able to get our arms moving in the right way and hit that ball.
Wow. And, JR, I bet you didn't realize when you were running up and down the field, you were actually in Einstein territory there with all this relative motion and everything.
I would say that that's the only name I haven't been called.
I heard that. Good call, Einstein.
Yeah.
Dr. Goff, how can our listeners pick up a copy of the book?
Well, the book is Gold Medal Physics, The Science of Sports. My last name is Goff, G-O-F-F. If you Google my name, John Eric Goff, you'll find my webpage. You can click a link to the Johns Hopkins University Press where it's published, or you could go on Amazon and find it.
Very good, sir. Anything you'd like to leave us with this morning?
How's the weather down in Texas? It's pretty rainy up here.
Oh, it's crazy down here. We had 3 to 5 inches of snow yesterday. Today it's going to be 47. Tomorrow it's going to be 63 and sunny.
Interesting weather these days.
Isn't it, though? Dr. Goff, thanks so much for being with us and sharing your great insight into the physics of sports.
Great. It was fun chatting with you.
Thank you, sir.
All right. Bye-bye.